Impact of Influence, The Murdoch Family Murders. This is the unfolding story of a powerful South Carolina family, the mysterious deaths they are linked to, and our quest to bring you the truth.
Hello, friend. So grateful you're back with us again. Do appreciate that. And first-timers, welcome as well. I am Matt Harris. Seton Tucker is with me as well. And we appreciate it again, as I said. You can find Impact of Influence on Facebook. You can also find the Impact of Influence YouTube channel that we're getting rolling, much to the chagrin of Seton.
Don't look.
Please look. Subscribe to that if you would. And please rate and share the podcast and make comments in that in the podcast section of whatever favorite podcast app you're using. We're part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Need to announce that too. So we are going to bring in our guests now and get rolling on this, because we are just, as we record this, days away from the evidentiary hearing to see whether Alec Murdoch will get a retrial from the double murder conviction, at least this stage of it. There's other ways he could get one as well, which will start in a few days. Also, it's about the one-year anniversary of the start of Alec's first trial, or maybe final trial. It was about a year ago in January.
Yeah, I just saw on Facebook today that I think jury selection began today as we're recording this, and that it is Dick Harpootlian's birthday.
Really? I did not know. Well, there you go. Happy birthday, Dick Harpootlian. So bring us in our guest, Seton.
We are pleased to welcome Nancy Jo Thomason Cannon. She is an attorney practicing in Anderson, South Carolina. She's been practicing for over 30 years and a graduate of the University of South Carolina Law School, as well as the University of South Carolina undergraduate as a journalism major, which she found really helpful in her law school studies.
Sure. Yeah. How did it all play? How did that help you out in your law studies?
Well, I think the writing skills that I learned in journalism school, when I was in journalism school, I'm so old that there were still newspapers around. So we actually had to write under, you know, the printed word. And so I think the writing skills that I learned really helped me in law school with my law school papers and kind of getting to the point of things when, you know, the who, what, when, where, why kind of things of journalism are pretty important, you know, in almost every kind of legal case that you have, you know, just the facts. Let's figure this out. I was never a good feature writer, so I wasn't good at fluffing things, but I was really good at getting to the facts and kind of boiling it down to what mattered, I think. And so I think that helped me in law school a lot and helped me in my practice as well.
And you are a listener of our podcast, and I love it when an attorney reaches out to us, because I'm always so flattered.
I have been listening to you guys. I can't say since exactly the beginning, but I've been listening to you guys since I found you. But I've kind of been in the transition to retirement since late 2021. And so this time last year, I was done with all my cases. I'm mediating now. And I kind of became obsessed with the Murdoch trial because I really didn't have anything else going on. It's funny, y'all were talking about the anniversary. My husband and I went to visit family and friends in the panhandle of Florida and then over in Mississippi, like the 10 days before the Super Bowl last year. And so the trial was in full swing. Mm-hmm. And we were obsessed with watching it in the car on court TV and so forth. So yeah, we were heavy into it. And I've just been real interested in the whole thing since the beginning. I didn't realize it, but I actually went to law school with Alec. I don't remember him because in law school, at least at USC, you had your small group, and then there were like five small groups that went to all the regular classes together. So if you weren't in that group of 100 to 150 students, you really didn't know the people in the other set of classes. And I guess he must have been in the other, because I didn't even know that we'd gone to law school till one of my fellow law students or friends who was in law school said, yeah, don't you remember him from law school? Like, no, I had no idea.
But yeah, every single player in this whole thing has been a USC law school graduate, it seems.
It speaks to the size of our state, though, that everyone has some sort of connection in some way.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. 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 But, you know, I when I reached out to you guys last week, and I had talked with Seton on the phone, one of the things I did want to say to you guys, and I wanted to say it on the air, is I'm just so appreciative at how unbiased I believe that you guys have been. I think you've done a really good job of letting people come on and give their perspective. And I think even when you guys are bantering about and discussing things, one of you will say, well, this, and the other one will say, well, but it could have been this. And so I just appreciate the fact that you guys are open to the possibility of, well, this could have happened, or that could have happened, or this could be the way that it goes. And I just think there's so much out there today in our media that is not from the perspective of, let's just present the facts and let's see, you know, let's analyze. It could go this way, it could go that way. So much of what we see in the news today is so opinionated and so you know, presented from the position of an opinion. And I just really appreciate what you guys are doing. Oh, so I wanted to give you those
kudos. Really nice. Thank you. That's what we were hoping for.
Well, we really appreciate it. And let's get to why you reached out. So one of the things you thought that possibly had not really been discussed very much was the obligations jurors have.
Yeah. So I've listened to Joe McCullough talk on your show. And I remember the episode where he specifically talked about SLED calling his clients and some of the other lawyers calling his clients. And you know, I think he said something to the effect of, we're going to wait and see what happens. And I'm going to try to make sure that my clients are only questioned once and not several different times, et cetera.
Right, right.
But nobody has said, at least that I've heard, I'm not going to say that I've listened to everything. But I have not heard anybody ask the question, could any of the jurors be in trouble if they say that they base their verdict on something other than what they were instructed to do, or if they were spoken to in a way that contradicted the judge's instructions that they didn't report it? And the reason that those questions came into my mind, and I specifically told Seton this when we talked, I had a trial probably been 20 years ago. I used to do a lot of what we call conflict work. If the public defender's office was representing one person, they couldn't represent a co-defendant. So they had to find another lawyer in the community who was willing to do that. And it was always good trial experience. So I enjoyed doing those cases. And so Robert Gamble, who was the public defender here at the time, and I had two murder defendants. They were trying them together. We started the trial. And it must have been day two, maybe it was day three, I can't remember. But we get this note from the judge, or there's a note that's given to the judge. The judge calls us in, and basically this juror has written a note to the judge and said, I can't be on this jury anymore. Looking at these two boys, they remind me of my nephews. There's no way I can find them guilty, even if I think this. I can't be unbiased anymore. I need to be off this jury.
Wow.
And I don't remember why there was no alternate. But again, apparently there wasn't. And so the case had to end in a mistrial. He had to let her off because she, you know, acknowledged bias. But he immediately instructed her to get an attorney because there was going to be a hearing later in the week as to whether or not she ought to be held in contempt for not following her juror oath and following his instructions. And so I just remember that. Of course, you know, we all showed up for the hearing and he didn't hold her in contempt. I think he scared her to death. But you know, and I never really discussed with him what his motivation for that was. Was it, you know, trying to set a precedent so word didn't get out with defendants or, you know, whatever. But ultimately, my question to Seton was, have none of the lawyers representing these jurors mentioned the fact that there is any legal implication to the jurors? So, for example, if someone came to you during the trial and said, I think you ought to find him guilty. He's guilty of sin. I believe, and I didn't watch all of the trial from beginning to end. Seton, I think you were there for everything, and you may remember this. Yes. Normally, in a criminal trial, the judge will instruct the jury at the beginning, you are not to talk to anyone, and you're not to allow anyone to talk to you. And I've heard judges say many, many times, And if somebody comes up to you and tries to talk to you, you don't worry about it. You let me deal with it. You just report it to me and I'll deal with that person. You just tell them you can't talk to them.
Judge Newman instructed, I don't know, I don't remember him saying, tell me about it. But I do remember the instructions
every time they were dismissed, do not discuss the case.
Yeah, every single time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But again, you know, I've heard judges say, you know, and if you're husband or your brother or your sister, if they just keep on bugging you about it or whatever, you let me know and I'll take care of that. Just trying to give, I guess, the jurors a little extra confidence in saying, I really can't talk to you about this. And if you keep bugging me, the judge is going to want to talk to you, right?
Yeah, right.
My question was, if a juror comes in and says, yes, the judge told us not to listen to anything outside of the witness testimony and the lawyer's arguments and his instructions. Those are the three things that we're supposed to listen to. And I'm here today to testify that this other person, whether it's a court personnel or not, said this and this to me. And I decided my verdict based on what that person said versus the three things, Judge, you told me to listen to, your instructions, the evidence from the witness stand, and the lawyer arguments.
I could see, though, a juror being confused with a court official. I am saying, possibly you would view the clerk of court or a bailiff as kind of almost an extension of the judge.
And that's typically how they communicate with the judge. It's not like the judge goes back into chambers and says, good morning, guys, what's going on? They do. They always communicate, usually through the bailiff. I don't know that I've ever known clerks, I mean, in my experience, usually, I mean, I've
heard that from a lot of lawyers. This is very unusual.
Yeah, the clerk would say to the bailiff, go ask the jury what they want today. Do they want Chick-fil-A again today or not?
Right.
You know, and then the bailiff would come in and say, they're sick of Chick-fil-A, Madam Clerk, can we get them some Burger King today or whatever? I mean, they heard those kind of conversations go on. So I always thought that the jury was completely insulated from even the clerk or the clerk's staff, that it was always the bailiff. At least that's been my experience. So the second thing that concerns me too is that they were polled at the end of the verdict. You know, they go through juror number one, is this your verdict? Yes. Number two, you know, and usually the judge says, is this your verdict based on all the evidence, et cetera, et cetera. If there was a problem, if you were thinking at that point, no, I really think I was swayed because of what I heard the clerk say or what I heard a bailiff say or what I heard somebody else say, wouldn't you have stood up at that point and said, hey, there's a problem. On the other hand, you're now in open court. You've already seen kind of the egg juror lady get a little bit embarrassed by what happened with her. I would be scared to death to then go, oh, but wait a minute. Oh, but wait a minute. I changed my mind again. I had to testify before in PCR hearings, et cetera. It's not fun being the one on the witness stand, I can assure you. And even for experienced trial lawyers, it's a little bit disconcerting. So I can also see from the perspective of a juror not really recognizing that they were influenced until having some time to reflect on it. Right.
When you're in the middle of something, like you might not know that somebody's saying something, especially a court official saying, let's assume that it was said, something like pay extra attention to his body language or be aware.
Don't be fooled.
Don't be fooled by this or that. So it's like more of a subtle kind of thing than he's guilty. And it might take you time to wrap your head around it.
One juror said that she took that to mean she felt that he was guilty.
Right.
In her affidavits.
But also you're saying that they potentially could be charged.
Right. I've heard y'all talk about the jurors by number. Yeah. I think it was juror 630 or 360 or whatever that y'all talked about last week, whose affidavit was the most strong towards having been influenced. And I think she's the one that's represented by Joe McCullough, right?
Yes.
If I'm Joe McCullough, I'm going to be saying, wait a minute. If she testifies that she or he, I don't know if it's a she or he, if my client testifies that they did something in contradiction to the judge's instructions, is my client now subject to some sort of sanction from the court?
If the real objective is to get justice, then you certainly want them to do an affidavit. You don't want them to pretend it didn't happen. And wouldn't it be a bad precedent to have a juror who, after the fact, realizes something was askew, then no jurors would ever come forward that something wasn't right?
You're right. It would have a chilling effect if somehow this juror was to be punished. But by the same token, I think it's important that in the future, jurors understand that, A, they can take as much time as they want, because one of the other things that seems to be a theme with what are some of these affidavits is you got to hurry up and make a decision, right? That seems to have been a theme.
Or at least there was incentive to hurry up, mm-hmm. right?
Jurors are kind of educated as a result of this, the publicity of this, that they're in charge at that point. Once the case is turned over to the jury, how fast or how long it takes is completely and utterly up to the jury. They're the ones that are in charge at that point, and no one should be making them feel as though they're on some sort of time clock.
And also, it's important to point out also that in the jury room, you can be pressured by other jurors that all that stuff is supposed to be confidential and never come out. And it doesn't, there's nothing leading to an appeal or anything like that. If a juror felt pressured by other jurors, that's just part of the possibility. Right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. I was telling Seton, I helped a colleague with a trial this summer where very strange set of circumstances happened immediately after the trial. It was almost like a Perry Mason moment where somebody else said, "Oh my God, we never thought he would get convicted. I really did it." Okay. it was crazy. So I had been kind of helping this attorney in the background, and because he might have ended up being a witness, I argued the motion for a new trial. And we had an affidavit from a juror who didn't hear the admission after the trial, but we got wind that the jury decided the client was guilty because he didn't testify, which obviously is completely contradictory to what the judge's instructions are. Mm-hmm. You are not to give any weight to the fact that the defendant doesn't testify. It's right. up to the state to prove it. And we actually had the jury foreman sign an affidavit that said, we blamed the defendant for not testifying. We held it against the defendant, you know, for not testifying.
So they didn't follow the orders.
It didn't follow the orders. And so we had a motion hearing on whether or not there should be an evidentiary hearing, whether or not the judge should actually call the jurors in. And we lost the motion hearing miserably. We didn't get a new trial. We didn't get an evidentiary hearing or anything. We would have preferred to have gotten a different result. But basically, the judge applied the standard in Green, the case y'all have been talking about for a couple of weeks now, which is what Justice Toll said she was going to do in this case. And it really does put the burden on the defendant to mm-hmm. show not only that there was some sort of communication or there was some sort of error, but that in and of itself caused the juror to vote differently than they would have otherwise. I think a big important piece of this is going to be, how are the questions worded?
This is what I've taken away from you as well as Joe McCullough and Eric Bland, is if you are a juror and these type of questions are coming about, it is best to have representation.
Absolutely. I think they all were very smart and wise to have somebody giving them legal advice.
We appreciate you coming on. It's been a good insight that we haven't had before on this kind of thing. Yeah. It's really, I appreciate you listening all this time and the kind words.
I enjoy it so much, and I'm worried that what we're going to focus on when this is all over.
we're worried too. We have to figure out our next avenue.
Yeah. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Right. Take care.
Bye. Thank you.
Let's talk about one of our sponsors. It is Factor. You can eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals.
Every fresh meal is never frozen and it is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, and they are ready in just 2 minutes.
What did you have chili the other day?
Delicious.
And if you want gourmet meals, you can try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, asparagus. So head to factormeals.com/ Impact 50 and use code Impact 50, 50, to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box.
That code's Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Impact 50 at factormeals.com/impact50 to get 50% off your first box and 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
From one attorney to another attorney guest, but this one's super special. One of the two great Matts in Seton's life.
Yes, we're happy to welcome my dad. He's been on the podcast before. Do we need to tell your whole deal?
Come on, Seton, give him like.
I'm trying to remember. I know he graduated from Penn Law School. He has practiced law for more years than he probably wants to admit. And he was previously a law clerk for which circuit?
Federal Third Circuit.
Yes.
And I also teach at Temple Law School.
See, Seton.
I know. I didn't do a good job. I should have had that in front of me.
as well as continuing to practice law in a major international law firm. So I've been around.
Where do you want to start with?
Okay. So we were talking this week several times after the pre-trial status conference and exactly what happened there. And I think we wanted to start off with, what is prejudice? Explain that to our listeners.
I'll put it in terms of the court clerk, which is a major issue, as I understand it, down there now before Justice Toll. The court clerk has a unique role that inherently garners trust and confidence in what she does. And such association with jurors can affect the jurors with prejudice sufficient to reverse those convictions theoretically. And the reason for that is the clerk is in a position to foster rapport prior to a jury's deliberation. And so then the real issue is, assuming she had contact with them, which I understand is the allegations which are being made by the defendants, the question is how severe is it? And is it what they call per se prejudice or deep prejudice or harmless contact of one sort or another? You know, there's been a lot of talk about the burdens of proof here, which means who has to prove the case, who wins. And let's talk about why that's important here and why that's going to drive the result.
Okay.
I think there's been some discussion on your podcast, and I know and a lot of the other journalists have been talking about the Supreme Court decision decided over 70 years ago, the Remmer case, which basically held that any private communication or contact with a juror during a trial about the matter pending before the jury is deemed presumptively prejudicial. My important words there, presumptively prejudicial under the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. Now, what does the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution say? Well, it says the defendants are entitled basically to an impartial and fair trial. So that if somebody has improper contacts with the jurors during the process, you know, that could deprive somebody of a fair and impartial trial, theoretically. Now, assuming that someone is able to demonstrate these contacts, it shifts the burden to the government. The importance of that is the shifting or the assignment of such burden is a way, in effect, of announcing a predetermined conclusion or decision or result. Now, why is that case? Why do I say that? Well, the reason is the evidence as to how a contact bias the jury is generally unavailable to anybody on something called the non-impeachment rule. So that, in other words, that if there is a contact with a juror, that's probative, but how that may have biased the jury's deliberation is not under this non-impeachment rule. And that's why the burden is important. Now, let's talk for a few minutes about what is this non-impeachment rule. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds with you guys, but this rule prohibits jurors from testifying about their deliberations. Okay. And the rule dates back to 1785. When Lord Mansfield ruled that a juror could not submit an affidavit alleging juror misconduct. And this continued in our common law for a long while. And it was finally adopted and settled by 1975 when the U.S. Congress enacted into the federal rules of evidence what they call Rule 606B6, which codified this common law. Rule 606B provides finality and the absolute privacy of jurors. Although Rule 606B preserved the common law exception that permits jurors to testify about improper extraneous contacts, it still excludes testimony about whether those contacts actually affected the jury's deliberation. Mm.
So that's why the burden is so important. Because
right.
We can't talk about what happened in the jury room. So whoever right. has the burden is really digging out of a deep hole.
Right. Yeah. And just thus, when the only fact either party can prove is whether or not this extraneous contact happened rather than what effect it had. So you're absolutely right, Seton. Or an example of that is whether a juror manifests bias during the deliberation because of these contacts. You can't get into that.
If they repeat, like said, oh, they go into the jury room and they're like, oh, I'm feeling this way because I heard the clerk of court say something. That can't be included.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So that's why shifting the burden party fails, because the only thing out there is the contacts. So just to put it another way, to put a cap on this, is the non-impeachment rule restricts evidence of whether extraneous contacts influences a jury verdict, which basically means that you're seeing the tip of the iceberg as to what took place, namely the contact. You're not seeing below the water as to how that might affect the jury's verdict. And that's why the shifting of burden of proof is very important.
Well, after this evidentiary hearing, it appeared as if Chief Justice Toll was keeping the burden with the defense, and she's relying on Green as her standard, which is a South Carolina case law.
Versus Remmer, which is federal, right?
Which is federal.
Yeah.
So... But she said she wasn't going to rule in a vacuum and that possibly something could change that would make a difference.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that, Dad?
Well, you know, my thought is that, and I wasn't there. I've read some reports of it. You've given me some information. Basically, I would guess that the first thing that will come in is what the contacts were. And then once they come in, the ultimate decision then is going to be whether or not that shifts the burden. And then if it shifts the burden, it's going to be very difficult for the government to win. If it doesn't shift the burden, it's going to be virtually impossible for the defendant to win.
Yeah. So where it stands now, it's the defense is in a deep, deep hole unless Justice Toll changes her mind.
Something changes in the course of this evidentiary hearing.
Right.
Now, I wanted to ask you about some of the terms that Chief Justice Toll used, where she wanted to keep it very focused and targeted. Why do you think she may be doing that?
I think that what she wants to do is not to make this a circus in a lot of ways. I think that she understands this, the inability to get into the jury's deliberations. So what she's basically trying to decide is the scope or the extent of these contacts, and were they such that could have resulted, in an unfair trial for Mr. Murdoch. I think that's what she's doing there. The other thing is a couple other little interesting things around this, too. You know, the South Carolina, as you know, is in the Fourth Circuit. You've heard that a number of times. And actually, the Fourth Circuit, if this was in federal court, has a fairly light way where it shifts the burden. So if there's something that arises simply above an innocuous contact, under the Fourth Circuit law, it would shift the burden to the government, which would make it very difficult for the government to win. But, you know, she's not following that. She's, following, she says, I guess it's the Green case in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Do I have that right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's Green. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's filing that case there. Now, there is an ability also to get to federal court, but that really doesn't help ultimately Murdoch all that much. that there's something called habeas corpus, where somebody can basically, it's a legal term, it's a Latin term, which basically means someone can say that I'm being improperly detained. So they can go in and claim that in a collateral way, in addition to the state court proceeding, that the constitutional right has been violated. The only problem with that in this case is that it really does not shift the burdens like it does in the state court proceeding that, that we're in now, or if this case had originally been in federal court. So it really doesn't help him out much. There's a lot of detail behind that, but I don't think you need to hear that unless you want to.
Could it be as simple as in this evidentiary hearing, could it be as simple as Justice Toll saying to, you know, juror one, did you hear anything from the clerk of court that was improper or whatever? And then number two, did anything you hear swayed you? Two questions, they're in and out each juror.
That seems to be what she is indicating is going to happen thus far.
Question, and out.
Out, right. I mean, Eric Bland, attorney for several of the deliberating jurors, asked how long his clients would need to be available. And, you know, she said one day should be sufficient.
Yeah,
I think the only thing that she's going to ask him, and I may be wrong, but the only thing she should ask him under the, you know, under the federal rules and you know, and what they can ask jurors and stuff like that is, did the contact happen? She can't really ask them then, you know, how that affected deliberation and what bias or didn't bias happen in deliberation. So the only question is, what to what level did the contact arise? So that once that comes out, the defendants then have to be prepared to make an argument that that was substantial enough to shift the burden. That's what it's going to come down to, I think.
Whatever happens in this evidentiary hearing, is that something that can be appealed, or is that not an appeal of an appellate kind of case?
They can appeal it through the appellate system in South Carolina, and they can also file this at any time, this habeas federal proceeding that I talked about.
Right.
I think that what the court would be looking at is on appeal, was there an abuse of discretion by Justice Toll in not shifting the burden in the way she handled the hearing that she's going to be handling next week, I guess.
Okay. You can tell he's a professor.
Yeah, the other thing I just like to say, all this really doesn't go to Murdoch's guilt or innocence.
No.
It really only goes to, did he have a fair trial?
People want to say, you know, he's guilty. Why are we going through this whole process? But they're not really gathering that it's just more about the right to a fair trial. I had one of my friends visiting, and her father stopped by, and he said, why are we doing this? Why are we going to waste all this money on a new trial for Alec Murdoch when the outcome is just going to be the same, which is highly possible, but I think it's our constitutional right and everyone deserves a fair trial. And don't blame the state of South Carolina for the money. I would say if someone did have improper contact, blame that person.
Yep.
Yeah, it's part of our system of government, part of our democracy, part of our court system, part of our constitution. It's a very important right to have an impartial and fair trial.
Great having you again, Matt. Appreciate it. And we'll have you back at some point soon.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dad.
Bye.
Pops was great again. And we do appreciate all of you. We're so grateful that you spent time with us. And check out the YouTube channel, Impact of Influence, on Facebook. Rate and share and comment wherever you are listening to this pod, part of the Evergreen Podcast Company. Talk soon, friend.
Something is creeping. Don't follow it down.
Let me introduce you to Barry Clue, an authorised financial advisor from New Zealand and a very special kind of stain on humanity.
He was a very knowledgeable young guy.
He was a registered financial advisor.
Type of guy that was bending over backwards to help you.
Now, you could be forgiven for thinking that Barry sounds like a great guy, and you'd be right. Well, right up until the point when you're wrong.
That was all fictitious.
She stole from my son, who has a disability.
Chris never knew. He died believing that we're all taken care of.
A psychopath is somebody who lacks empathy, acts impulsively. I think there's a strong case that Barry might be all of those things, actually.
To find out how Barry Clue stole over $15 million from 81 victims, subscribe to Clueless, The Long Con. That's Clueless, spelt Klooghless.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.